You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, all right. All right, all right, so here we are. Living it day by day, you are a superstar. And he says what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and today I welcome former World Wrestling Federation star Outback Jack to the program. Outback Jack, welcome to OWW Radio.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Outback Jack. How are you doing today?
David, how are you, mate?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for joining me on OWW Radio. How have you been?
I'm okay. You know, the normal life complications have come along with professional wrestlers after they've been beaten and put away wet, you know?
Well, I know there's been some complications with your health over the past couple of years. Are you feeling okay?
For the situation is, yes. If I was feeling any better, I'd rust.
You know, when you were wrestling, you were billed from Humpty Doo, Australia. But I don't know where you really grew up.
Well, no, I didn't. Yes, of course. I didn't grow up in Humpty Doo. I managed to find my way there at some point. I grew up in the bush, went to a small country school, two rooms, about 40 students and 12 horses. And I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s. And there you are. It was, straightforward country school.
Mm-hmm. What was your first exposure to pro wrestling?
I used to watch pro wrestling with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. It was on television, because she only got television on the weekend because of the way the signals went. I watched with Granny at 12 o'clock both Saturday and Sunday for World Championship Wrestling. And it was put on at the time by the NWA, I believe it was. And some of the stars from back then were Killer Carl Cox, Tex McKenzie, Australian stars, of course. There was Steve Rackman. Red Bastine was out there.
Right.
Bulldog Brow was out there. It was big in Australia. It was big.
Obviously, to have achieved the level of success you did in professional wrestling, you were a very, very good athlete. Growing up, did you star in any other sports?
Oh, I played football, yeah. But I played Aussie Rules, and I played rugby league. Mm-hmm. And I also was, at one point there, I was what you would consider a first-class cricketer. I played men's country A-grade cricket, and bit of luck, different place. I probably would have played for either New South Wales or played for Australia eventually.
A good friend of mine really loves cricket. He's from India. I don't understand the game. Did the games themselves go on for a day or so?
Club cricket goes on for a weekend. It'll go Saturday and Sunday. But when you get up to test level, you'll either have a simple one-day series where back in when I played, it was 50 overs a side, and or then you would play test matches, which play for 5 days. You play four continuous days, a day off, and you play the fifth day.
That's interesting.
And the test cricket is a little complicated. There's no doubt about that. The rules are the same, of course, but you're trying to get one side out so you can get in, to get them all out so you can go back in and get in and out again.
Well, I love the story about watching pro wrestling with your grandmother. I think it's fascinating how pro wrestlers decide to make this a career. But what happened, Outback Jack, that made you say, I'm going to start going to training?
Oh, that was easy. I was up in the bush. I'd been off... I'd become disenfranchised with the world, I suppose, is a word that I've learned to use, having seen this administration. Disenfranchisement is a very astute word. Mm-hmm. So I'd become disenfranchised with the world, and I was working on a cattle station actually just out of Humpty Doo. And if you're looking for Humpty Doo, actually, it's just out of Darwin. There's the road to Catherine that heads straight south from Darwin. About 30 miles out south of Darwin is the... very simply there, you make a left-hand turn and head east towards Never Neverland or Arnhem Land. And about 15 miles off that road, you'll run into Humpty Doo, mm-hmm. which during the week has a population of about 60. And then of a weekend, because it's got the only pub, it has a population of about 200. And you drive about 80 miles further east, and you come across Marion Drow Grove's cattle station, and I was working there. And again, it was a weekend thing. You'd come in of a weekend, you'd knock off on Friday night, and you'd get into the pub, probably around 8 or 9 o'clock. You'd have a half a dozen beers, and you'd get set for the next day to have a big old drink and feed and just carry on in general. And of course, on the satellite television, there would come the wrestling from Madison Square Garden. Mm. And so we'd watch the wrestling from Madison Square Garden. And on this particular day, we were watching the wrestling, and lo and behold, through the door comes this, actually first came through as a 12-inch cigar, then this 5'10" rotund fella named Arnold Scholand, and along with him came Hillbilly Jim, and Special Delivery Jones, and they were doing a wrestling match. They were doing a show in at the arena in Darwin, and they wanted to see what a real fair dinkum pub was like. So they came out to the Humpty Doo pub, and we just happened to be there. And I was drinking with Norm at the time, and Norm was a almost 20-month-old Brahma bull. And Norm would drink all your beer. He'd just grab your can, squash the can, drink it, suck it, and spit the empty can across the room. And so I was drinking with him, and this Arnold Scholar fellow said, son, can you show us what a cattle station looks like? And I said, yeah, sure. Have you got some tickets to the matches tonight? We'll take a bunch of us in, and I'll take you out tomorrow and show you what a cattle station is. So we did that. I took them out the next morning. I got them, picked them up at around 6 a.m. and drove them out to the cattle station. And they were amazed to see that actually once you got to the front gate of Mary and Joe Grove's place, they were amazed to see that it was about 65 miles from the front gate to the center of the property to where the station house was. And, you know, they thought they'd heard of big properties, 100,000 acres. Well, this Mary and Joe Grove's place was, I think, 670 square miles. So it was much bigger than that. And So I took them around with a bunch of other fellas. We took them buffalo hunting, crocodile hunting, and just general life on the farm, as it were. And Arnold Scholar says, kid, you should be a wrestler. This is great. You're a character. I said, yeah, that'd be great, you know. I said, send me a love letter to the Humpty Doo pub. And I guess that went on to finish the rest of the tour of Australia. And about 6 or 8 weeks later, I go in for Saturday morning drinks. And Louis Drucker, owned the pub, he says, hey, there's a letter here for you from the United States. And it was the big old letter with the WWF logo up in the corner. I opened it up. Dear Jack. And it was a letter from Vince McMahon and his president of International Wrestling Promotions, to Jim Troy. And we'd love to have you, blah, 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 blah. He was a $1,000 check just to get you going. And we'll be over to see you in 3 weeks. Please sign that confirmation thing, rah, rah, rah. So I signed it, set it off. The first thing I did, of course, was cash the check.
For sure.
And... then they, 3 weeks later, they bloody arrived. And I was dumbstruck. And they said, we're going to take you back with us, you're going to be a professional wrestler. So they did. And that was that. I had to be trained, of course. But they sent me up to Calgary. And I trained up there for a while. I worked out at Stu Hart's place for a little bit, and then I got actually I left there and went to Les Thornton's place. And the man of a thousand holes. I mean, he was fantastic. And we trained every day. There was myself, Bill Kazmaier, the world's strongest man at the time, and another fellow, Dave Barbie, and we trained every day at the Calgary Stampede. And then of a night, we trundled off, got in our trucks, and drove all around Canada wrestling every night. And that was it. That was good. That was fun.
Yeah, that is really an amazing story. I've never heard that before, and I appreciate you sharing it. Calgary itself, of course, was a well-respected territory over the years. What do you remember about Stu Hart, and did you spend a lot of time with Brett and Owen?
I spent a bit of time with Stu. You know, I had some reservations, nothing really about them, but there seemed to be a delight in punishing new wrestlers. And I just wasn't up for that. You know, it was fun for Stu to get everybody down in the dungeon and stretch them and put holes on it. You know, I mean, in real life, you'd never in one second allow yourself to get put in that position. But once Stu got you in it, I mean, it was, you had to submit. Otherwise, you'd break an arm, break a shoulder, break your neck. You know, Calgary was wild. It was wild. You know.
Mm-hmm. There's some great books written about Calgary and about the travel, like you say, and you know, snow and all these crazy long road trips.
The very first one that I went on that was that shocked me. Do you remember the movie Cool Runnings?
Oh, of course, yeah.
The Jamaican bobsled team that turns up in Calgary for the Olympics.
Yep.
Well, I was there in 86. Just everybody's getting ready for the Olympics. And, of course, I'd come from Australia where it was 110 degrees in the shade and turn up in Calgary. And at the time, there was this famous Chinook blowing. So I turned up in Calgary and it was 55 degrees. So I thought, this is no big drama. And one of the very first trips we went in, we jumped in the two vans. I mean, the baby faces went in one van and the heels went in the other van. And we were driving to a place that was 9 hours northwest, I believe, or northeast, one way or the other. And it was called Regina, Saskatchewan. And we're driving up there. We get about, I would say, 5.5 hours in the trip. And we stop at a gas station and fill up with gas. And then I'm just looking out the window, and the whoever it was, it might have been Smith, the eldest brother of the Harts, might have been Smith Hart. He was squeezing this tube of additive into the gas tank, and I said, "Hey, what's he doing?" And I can't remember who it was sitting beside me. He said, "Oh, he's putting in the additive." I said, "Well, what's the additive for?" He said, "Well, it's to stop the gasoline from turning to jelly." I said, "Why would the gasoline turn to jelly?" He said, "Well, it gets cold." I said, "And gasoline's cold?" He said, "No, it gets cold, where it gets so cold that the gasoline turns to jelly and won't flow properly through the fuel injectors." And I'm like, "Oh, that's a load of crap." Anyway, we get to Regina, Saskatchewan. All the buildings in Regina, Saskatchewan run north-south. I mean, nothing runs east-west. It all runs north-south. And we're in this Holiday Inn, and there's a big old portiere, and the weather had sort of closed in, as it were. So I jump out of the truck. I've been in the truck for like 9 hours. I've peed twice, but you get out, the first thing you do is stretch and take a big old lung full of air. Well, I took a big old lung full of air, and I grabbed my chest, and I collapsed to the ground. And it was minus 40 degrees Celsius.
Oh, my
outside.
God.
And I chilled my lungs. And I spent 3 days in hospital warming back up. And we were stuck in Regina for 5 days, 4 or 5 days with this blizzard. And you couldn't Yeah, I mean, I'd never heard the how you get the emergency services beep, beep, beep across your radio. And this is a test. This is the test of the emergency services system. Well, I'd never heard it ever. I mean, I'd never heard it before. And they were warning you, do not go outside. Do not expose skin. Any skin that is exposed to the air will freeze in under 1 minute. And I couldn't believe how cold it was. And so I get back to the hotel. I'm fine, and I've recovered. And of course, first thing I did is I went out and bought myself a big old down coat. So I was big as it was. I now look like a very, very big Michigan tire man. But I was warm. That was the most important thing. And Cap says, come on, have a look at this. We went onto the leeward side of the building, and we had a cup of boiling water. He said, watch this. And the wind was howling through at about 45 knots. And we threw it into the air at the end of the building. And I swear, before it had gone 15 feet, it had turned to ice and smashed against the building on the other side of the street. It was so cold up there, the ground screeched when you walked on it. we thought, okay, at least the arena's going to be heated. And we wrestled in a place where they put sheets of plywood down over a hockey rink. And I'm like, this place is 38 degrees. I don't keep my meat this cold. After that, the storm went away, and we drove even further north to a place called Yellowknife, which I think is right on the edge of the Arctic Circle, and we wrestled for a bunch of Cherokee Indians. They don't smile very much, I've noticed. Yeah? The women have amazing long raven hair. Mm-hmm. My God, they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, moving right along.
When you were wrestling in Canada, what were you, the Outback Jack character, or what were you billed as?
Yeah, I was Outback Jack. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I landed in New York, and they shipped me out the next day. I was Outback Jack. I've always been Outback Jack.
Always been. That's interesting. And I guess the thought there was to take advantage of the mainstream popularity of the Australian film Crocodile Dundee. And it's funny because a lot of people struggle to find the character that they want to play. Or WWE repackages people all the time. They can't find what someone should present themselves like in the ring. And so from the beginning, this is what you are going to be. And
well, it was fortuitous because it was all basically within about a month of one another, I suppose. And I don't know if Dundee fashioned himself off me or I fashioned himself off him. I certainly know I'm taller than him.
And it sounds like the character is also realistic in the sense that you liked the outdoors, you were from Australia. So, in some ways, you were able to pick up that part of the business, the character part, pretty easily, I would think.
I was absolutely three-dimensional, as opposed to what you write up and pull off the page.
Right. And then you made your in-ring WWF at the time debut in November of 1986 and scored some nice wins along the way against some of their mid-card stars such as Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik. This was right during the rise of Hulkamania. What was it like to be stepping right into the WWF at that time?
Well, it was a little bit like Cinderella without the glass slippers. Mm-hmm. Myself, personally, or if you want to say Jack, if you want to talk in the third person, I couldn't go anywhere. I mean, without drawing a crowd. I remember the first time I went to Madison Square Garden, I actually had to leave because I went in to watch the matches and people started to recognize before I was ready to even have a debut there. And I had to leave because I was just too big a distraction. And then when I went in to wrestle, at the time at the stage door at the exit there, off the side of 33rd Street, you couldn't get out. You there'd be 2,000 or 3,000 people waiting for autographs and wanting to touch you and talk to you. And that was the case all over. I remember once I lived in Fairfield, Connecticut at the time, and if you've ever been up the turnpike in 95, along the way there's service, and they've always got a McDonald's. And unfortunately, McDonald's and I always got on well. So I pulled into this one particular one, and I pulled up at the drive-thru, and I was placing my order, so I placed my order, and before I even drove up, the girl said, "Are you Outback Jack?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And she even recognized me through the order box going through a drive-thru at McDonald's in, on 95. Yeah, at any one time, I guess, Vince had three shows on, three TV shows going, and you were, I'd say, audience-wise, you probably, on a week, you would pass through 70 million households or homes that would be watching the wrestling.
Right, and I understand, that there were several cards running through the country, different cities, but if you were on the card with Hulk Hogan, you hear wrestlers say it was just unbelievable. He was such a big star. Had you ever seen anything like his popularity?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. No, you wanted to be on the card with Hulk because it made a difference to your payday without a shadow of a doubt. Mm-hmm. And, you had a much larger, much more intensive crowd. Although, the same can be said. When you did there was an A, B, C circuit. If you're on the C circuit doing high schools and fairgrounds, you go to some of the smaller venues like out in Pennsylvania, some of the smaller high schools. These auditoriums still hold 3,000 people, but good grief, they would scream their lungs out for you, and they'd have a blast. Mm-hmm. And it was good to be there. You got the same sense of atmosphere from a small high school arena. So you did to Madison Square Garden. You just had to know that, wait a minute, I'm wrestling in Madison Square Garden in front of 29,000 people. I remember the second time I was at Madison Square Garden, I think I was going to wrestle Nikolai Volkov. Anyway, I called my mum and my dad back home, and I went out and used a calling card, used a little payphone, and I spoke to him. I said, I'm wrestling at Madison Square Garden in New York City. He was like, "Wow, that's amazing." What? I said, "Yeah, we've sold out the house." I said, "There's 29,000 people at the arena," and he was like, "Holy cow!" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Dad, you gotta know the history of this place. This place has been around for, I guess, at that point, probably 60 years, I suppose." And I said, "This is where they've had." Muhammad Ali's boxed here. The boxing world championships have taken place. Basketball, ice hockey. I said, "This is amazing. This is the mecca of it all." And he was impressed, and so was I. And everywhere you went, especially in the major towns, there was history. And actually, that's an amazing thing that I found. You get blind to a lot of things, especially. Over home, you'd get blind to where you were. Like if you walked across the Sydney Harbour Bridge, it's just a quick way to get a mile and a quarter across the water, where you don't even think about the Sydney Opera House. But these are mechanical wonders of the world. Mm-hmm. And when I was out of Ayers Rock, to climb Ayers Rock and walk to the centre of Ayers Rock, that's a mile walk at about 800 feet up. But they're commonplace. Where, for me, when I traveled the United States, it was like I was in Disneyland the whole time, because everything was like, Jesus, this is just like it is on television, but it's actually real.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned 3,000 people or so able to come to those C rotation shows. There aren't indie promotions around anywhere drawing that kind of crowd today.
Probably not. No, I've got a couple of mates that do indie shows, and they're ecstatic if they get 300 people.
Exactly.
It's a lot tougher too, because I feel bad for the chaps. We didn't have to do too much. I mean, obviously, I'll be a little rude and arrogant here. We were the best of the best. To get the same pop out of the crowd, I guess what you have to do today is insane to what we did back in the 80s and 90s. I mean, everybody juicing every night and barbed wire matches and all that. I mean, it's just crazy. I remember how when I watched that movie, The Wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it and I watched it and I thought, and I got more and more and more depressed. And I was like, this is sad, man. This is, I mean, I was not a happy camper when I left that, because it just showed you, actually, in some instances, how miserable our lives were, especially when you just couldn't give it up. And that is the one difficulty that a lot of the top talent have, is there's always the echo of the cheers.
Mm-hmm.
And the echo still echoes in your ear, but you don't necessarily hear it anymore, and you can't always find it, and you go looking for it.
I've never heard that term used before. I really like that, the echo of the cheers. That's pretty interesting. And you talked about the way your matches were put together back in the 80s. I kind of liked it better, Outback Jack, because I thought there was a slower pace. There was more emphasis on storytelling. There was less spot after spot after spot. I thought that you allowed the characters to kind of define themselves and tell a story, which is different than today. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. You have to tell a story, because if you break it down and look at it, it's a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And you like to see a cartoon from the beginning to the end. There has to be a middle, a bit of a story, and then there has to be a high point.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've either got to get the payoff, or you've got to be disappointed so there's a payoff for the next time. So you can, I mean, we would go around specifically working with someone for 4 or 5 months to get to work up to an event so that you can tell the story and get the payoff. And you don't do that anymore. You just, I guess it's the impatience of the business.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's been a lot of stories about life on the road, especially in the 1980s when WWF at the time had all of you moving all the time. Did you have a traveling crew that you hung out with, or were there a lot of ribs all the time?
It depends. You know, you go to TV. TV was a 2, sometimes 3-day event, and the first thing you went looking for was your sheet. And you'd get your sheet and you'd get your tickets. And you'd go down your sheet and see where you were working, who you were working with, and you'd check your tickets, make sure all your airfares and airliner tickets were right. And, I mean, sometimes in a month, you'd obviously be on, in some instances, 30 planes a month.
Oh.
And you'd see the whole card. So it might be, I'll just use a simple one, Outback Jack versus Iron Mike Sharp. Okay, you'd see what other babies are working, what other heels are working. And then you'd obviously avoided traveling with heels. Sometimes you couldn't help it. But, you know, you'd work out a crew as to, you'd get to a town, you'd know the hotels you were going to stay in. And then if there was somewhere you had to go that was, like, if the next town was under 150 miles, I believe, you would drive to it. So, you know, you try and rent one car and fit 5 fellas in and drive to the show. And then instead of it costing you $90 for the car for the day, you know, everybody'd weigh in their freight, fill it up with gas, and you'd cut your road costs, you know. And the one concession I gave myself, no matter what or wherever I was, if I could, I would find at least a 4-star Sheraton hotel to stay in on a Saturday night. And mm-hmm. If I couldn't, I'd find the equivalent. And that was sort of my bubble bath to me, you know. but every other night I would stay in a Red Roof Inn or, you know, some of the Motel 6s, Motel 8s, whatever, again, mm-hmm. to save your money. But, you know, sometimes you'd get together at TV and say, like a lot of times I'd work with the Rougeau brothers. And I'd say, hey, we're out in so-and-so, so-and-so. I'd go, yeah, do you want to hook up? Yeah, sure, let's do that. And you'd set a crew. You'd set a traveling crew.
Mm-hmm. Pro wrestling would seem to bond people on the road, but by the nature of the business, it is also very, very competitive. Did you feel tension from time to time in the locker room, everyone kind of protecting their spot?
Yeah, always. You always felt tension. I mean, not so much with the, you know, because you had 2 separate, you know, them and us room, dressing rooms. But there were times, depending who you were with, you had to work to get your spot.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried as best as I could to always make it easy. You know, I maybe took a little too good care of some people. You know, I mean, like if I was body slamming someone, I'd slam them, but I'd always have a very big grip on the back of their neck because I didn't want to drop anybody. And there were some moves that I would never do a pile driver. I just didn't want to have, when you're all sweated, the slip and actually drive someone's head into the mat. You had to rely on one another to protect one another. But there were Nikolai Volkov and I, we had a couple of run-ins. There were some nasty ones where we actually exchanged blows. The worst one was in Europe. And we were setting up some spots before we were in Rome. And he said to me, I'm well known over here. I said, yeah, that's fine. He says, I want a press slam. And I said, okay. I said, if you press slam me, just make sure that I can body slam you and do whatever I need. He says, no problem. So I let him do the press slam, gets me up, pushes me up above his head. Which is no feat of strength either. I weighed about 290 pounds then. I mean, you can only get someone up so far with a bit of help, but to get them up the rest of the way, you got to do that yourself.
Sure, sure.
And so he slammed me, and that was fine. We did our bit. And then I went to pick him up to slam him later on in the match. We had to get 35 minutes, so we've got time to build up to it. Well, I went to pick him up, and, you know, he bloody sat on my arm, meaning that instead of lifting up as I would scoop him, he'd sit down. And so I'm trying to lift his 300 pounds just off my forearm. And I was pissed. So I pushed him in the corner. I said, what are you doing? And he just looked at me goofy, and I thought, you know, screw you, champ. And I smacked him in the side of the head. And he punched me back, and then I thought, okay. And I belted him hard in the head, in the ear, actually, and I split his ear.
And we
sorted it out after that. Yeah. There were some shots exchanged. Actually, the worst match I ever had was in the Montreal Forum. And it was against a Canadian fellow called Steve Strong.
Mm-hmm.
He was known as a crowbar. He was evil. He was evil to people. Big fella, probably 6'3", 6'4", 280, and would be, if he could be, a football player, ripped. And it was almost from the beginning we started bashing one another. And it went on for young and old in the ring. And he hit me three times in the jaw. And I have to admit that at one point he hit me so hard in the jaw, the only thing that kept me on my feet was I went up along the side of the ropes and I thought, Jesus Christ, if I count any more stars, I'm going to go into orbit. Anyway, I sorted him out too. I told him, I threw him into the ropes and I said, watch your gap. And I buried my fist to his spine and his stomach. I picked him up and rolled him up into a package and let him, because he was to get the... I had to put him over. So I put him over, flicked him off, and went straight, just walked out straight back to the locker room. And then it was on for young and old in the locker room.
Wow.
And the whole job was a setup.
Mm-hmm.
The whole job was a setup. It was set up by Pat Patterson. He was a slime.
Wow.
Still is a slime.
You know, unfortunately, a year or so after your debut, you saw your career kind of start to even out in WWE. You started putting guys over such as Ted DiBiase, Rick Rude, etc. Were you concerned at this time about the direction of your career?
No, I didn't think about those fellows. DiBiase was a gentleman, and Rick Rude was a good bloke, and they were big time talent. It was at that point, if you're playing the cartoon in your head, it's a Clash of the Titans, you know. So I had no problem with that. The time I got that I had a real troubled time with was putting Steve Lombardi over in New Haven, Connecticut. Now, someone sent me a message here. This is a load of crap.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole situation there was I'd taken a certain stance on things, and I'd said a couple of things just quietly that I thought I was saying to trusted ears, and of course it got back to the office, and started to become persona non grata.
Mm. Well, you did have some good feuds with Frenchie Martin and Ron Bass, among others, during your time there. Who would you have most enjoyed working with that you did not get a chance to wrestle?
I worked with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best matches I ever had was with Macho Man Savage, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I had great matches with King Kong Bundy. Iron Sheik was great to work with. We did a match in Landover, Maryland, and Sheiky and I, we had to get almost 40 minutes.
Oh.
And we worked, ran around and did stuff. And I mean, we didn't touch one another for about 32 minutes. It was classic. It was classic. And, who was it? It's one, I'm going past the crowd on the outside because Sheik is doing this zigzag in and out of the ring, and of course I'm chasing. We sort of look a little bit like Keystone Cops, but the crowd was eating it up. Anyway, this arm reaches out from the crowd and says, "Outback, bring him over close. I'll stick a knife in him for you." And I'm like, holy crap. This fellow really had it in his mind. He was going to bury a shiv into the belly of the Iron Sheik. So people took it pretty serious. And that was a good hell of a match. It really was.
That's kind of what you're talking about the storytelling, though, where you guys are running around chasing each other. You're building the story.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And you had to. And it you work the crowd into a froth,
mm-hmm.
and then you give them the payoff. And you don't always have to be in there doing high spot after high spot. I mean, yes, they do need to see a high spot. They do need to see a high spot, without a doubt. And especially if you can get them screaming from the rafters. And that was one of the things that Bass and I used to do. Ron Bass would come in with his bullwhip. And, of course, I always had my crocodile knife in the back of a belt. And I'd pull that out. And, of course, you know, Ron always put the knife over because it was like it had a 15-inch blade, so it's imposing. And, of course, he'd run away with his whip. So we told the story of that. And the same with Honky Tonk Man. We used to do that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good fellow to work with.
Yeah.
And there really wasn't anybody terribly bad. There were a couple of sloppy fellas, but, you know, one of the hardest fellas I found to work with, though he was great, was Don Morocco.
Huh.
And he wasn't hard from the standpoint that he was incompetent, and not at all. He was way and far better than most. But the thing was, he worked so very light. It was mm-hmm. it was tough to tell when he was actually doing something, and it made it difficult. I found it made it difficult for me to sell.
Some of the biggest shoulders I've ever seen on a man, Don Morocco.
Oh yeah, no, I made a mistake of working out with him for 3 weeks. And I said, I got to get my shoulders, because I've got big shoulders, but I never had that definition. I said, I want to do your shoulder exercise. I said, okay. And we worked out for 3 weeks. I couldn't scratch my other side of my head. Oh, my Lord. I just couldn't do it. It burned me out so hard. But, you know, a good bloke, no question, and funny, although he mumbled a lot. But just, he worked a little, and my favorite fellow to work with was Iron Mike Sharp, because he worked heavy, but it wasn't cruel heavy. It was like when you got a chop across the chest from Iron Mike Sharp, it was like you'd had a lump of timber slapped across your chest. But that was, to me, that was good, because it made all the noise. It made it easier to sell, because it stung like crap, you know. And that was, and actually, Hammer Valentine, Greg Valentine was good with the chop across the chest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good. I liked to feel the contact, so it just made it easier to sell. You know, more noise, the crowd buys it, and you know, nothing they're going to do unless they stick you with a knife in the middle, you know, make you bleed, or they belch you in the nose. You know.
Now, you made an appearance on the interview segment, The Snake Pit, of course, hosted by Jake the Snake Roberts in June of 1987. People universally regard Jake as one of the best minds in the business. That's hard to argue, isn't it?
very smart fellow. I mean, the one thing he did that made him smarter than most was he kept a little notebook, and he wrote down bits and pieces of stuff. So he, whatever he had, you know, he had thought of and written, and that wasn't even that he was committing it to memory. He was just making notes. So he knew, he did his research is basically what I'm saying, yeah. The one thing I found odd was, you know, you're interviewing Outback Jack, you got Damien there on the thing, and I'm supposed to put over the snake. You know, I mean, you're kidding me. I would grab a snake like that, turn it into a pretzel, and make it into a garter. So why am I putting over the snake? That just never made sense. I did what I was told.
Now, that's a great point. Is that against the face of your character?
Exactly. It was like, and I had my knife, and I was like, I could cut this snake's head off with the flick of a wrist.
Yeah.
And, you know, make it into several hat bands or several belts. Why should I put the snake out? You know?
I read in an interview that the WWE had planned for you and Hillbilly Jim to win the tag team championship, but plans were canceled for reasons that were never really made clear. Any thoughts on that today?
Yeah, I know exactly why that went that way. We teamed up together as tag partners, and we got together for the very first time in San Diego for a TV shoot. And I'd been in Phoenix the night before with the Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation. And I can't remember who I was working with, but anyway, the next day was TV. So that night I'm having a few beers, and I like to have my beers. I mean, you know, sort of all there is to do. But I hadn't quite then wised up to the notorious nature of the Bulldogs and the Harts. And I had my beer severely spiked with pills.
Wow!
And I made it to TV, but and I had to get my hair cut to a point where I virtually shaved my head in that TV debut, and I was seriously messed up. I mean, I did the match and we did well, and I remember doing a quick step in the middle of the ring, and I mean, I was really, really unimpressed by it all. And, of course, the Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation, they didn't make it. They went home. And the whole thing was a setup, and I believe to this day was perpetrated by somebody at the Home Office. And I got very, I mean, I somebody put like 6 or 7 halcyons in my beer. And, I drank it. And next thing I know, my head fell off, and that was that.
Wow.
But that's why that never went anywhere, because I was completely screwed up the next day.
Mm-hmm. What a shame. And by the way, I had the opportunity to work with Hillbilly Jim last month at a show here in Ranson, West Virginia. Just the nicest guy in the world. Do you keep in touch with Hillbilly at all?
I haven't spoken to Hillbilly for 25 years, and I was going to go to an autograph show in New Jersey, but I had to beg off for health reasons, unfortunately. And I would love to be put in contact with Hillbilly, because he's an absolute nature's gentleman.
Yeah, a really nice guy. I wanted to talk for a few seconds here about the merchandising at the time in World Wrestling Federation. Just was incredible. Lunchboxes and T-shirts. And you yourself, of course, have an LJN Wrestling Superstars action figure created in your likeness. By the way, I think those are the best action figures ever. I have them all. I have certainly have one of you, and I hope you have a few lying around.
I don't have as many as, well, actually, now I don't have any. I did give a bunch of them to my son when he was like 5 and 6, of course, and they were his favorite dive bombers in the bath, where he'd set out all his ships and they'd be, you know, naming. He would, Outback Jack would leap off the side of the bath and crash tackle the destroyers or aircraft carriers, and he had a hoot with those. But there was dolls, and it was an interesting turn of events.
You departed from WWF at the time rather suddenly, and without being too personal, can you explain kind of why you left the company?
things were obviously starting to slow down, and I had an opportunity to do a TV show called This Is Adventure Without Matt Jack, and I was putting my own money into it, and I had actually gone to speak to Vince, and this is the one thing about Vince that so many people don't know. If he doesn't think of it, it doesn't exist, mm-hmm. and he doesn't like anybody else's input. And I'd been to him with a couple of ideas that he'd poo-pooed, and of course, at that point, it didn't help that I'd married one of the staff, because that was a complete and total no-no. And maybe he was bent out of shape about that. I don't know, but we clashed over This Is Adventure Without Back Jack, and I stopped wrestling, and that was basically it. They went on for. I mean, I did a lot of spot shows after, but. You know, it wasn't the same Jack, that's for sure.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because we did not see you appear, like, in WCW then for, you know, a long run or anything. Were there other promotions that called you or tried to bring you in?
Jim Barnett and I had talked about going to WCW, but I think there was an issue there that Vince wouldn't release my character. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm.
And to be quite frank, I was easy fodder for a lot of the older wrestlers with their ribs and I absolutely, as best as I tried, I didn't get on with the Hart Foundation and the Bulldogs. The Bulldogs, as much as you want to say about them, and you know they're not doing so well nowadays. Like one of them's dead and the other's mostly dead. They're absolute pieces of dog crap. Always have been and always will be.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories about they just weren't very nice to anybody.
Well, you know, we had a team come in, the Rockers. It was Larry Minetti and Shawn Michaels, that's it, yes. And they actually lasted one TV. And the Bulldogs H-bombed them and did all sorts of stuff to them, and they left. And they just destroyed them. And it wasn't until later that Shawn Michaels came back to be Shawn Michaels. But the Bulldogs were way gone by then.
Mm-hmm.
If there was cutthroat nature in the business, it was absolutely there, perpetrated to the nth degree by the Bulldogs. And not Davey Boy Smith so much, because Davey Boy Smith was as dumb as a fence post.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly his agent provocateur, the Dynamite Kid, bad, bad man.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're not the first person to tell that story, and it's disappointing to hear that that would be the case. I did want to ask you, looking back on your career, what do you think people most remember about the Outback Jack character?
I think that he was a good, jolly, straightforward, honest bloke, and that was me. You know, I don't have a surreptitious bone in my body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean that. Doesn't mean that I should be sainted like Mother Teresa. That's not what I'm saying. But I don't have maliciousness on a human level, if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, what are you doing today? You haven't been wrestling for a while. What are you doing today to stay busy?
I'm a real estate developer, and I also have a small hedge fund.
Very good.
The real estate is I have 70 waterfront lots in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not lots that are sold by the gallon. They are lots with deep water frontage. And we're finishing up the final development, getting the plat, and we'll have them for sale next spring, I should think. And when I left the WWF, after I basically spent all my money on the TV show, I went in and I worked in the financial markets at Lehman Brothers, and I eventually became a bond trader, then an options and futures trader, and a currency trader.
Wow.
So I stay with the markets, and you know, my days start around 5 a.m. And I read, even though I'm blind now, I still have connection to about 400 newspapers around the world,
mm-hmm.
and I stay on top of it. Yeah, so, yeah, some of the injuries have caught back up with me, and there's no doubt about that. I do have a severe limp in my left leg. It's about 18 inches shorter than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 95% blind at present.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of those things, a small health issue brought on by other events during another time.
Mm-hmm. aside from the businesses you have going on, do you follow professional wrestling at all? Do you watch any of the
I catch it for a little bit, you know, and watch it every now and then. And you say, oh, shit, I could have done that. You know? But then it's like, oh, my God, how did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but do I miss it at 60 years of age? No, I don't miss it at all. You know, I'm still big. I'm still 6'4", 6'5", and up until about 6 months ago, I could still bench press 250 for regular numbers. You know, I work out 4 days a week, but as I've said, I've had a couple of health issues that slowed me down. I mean, I know we got the big send-off a little while back. I went into hospital and had congestive heart failure where I had put on about 55 pounds in water weight in 10 days, and I was in and had to be drained. I looked like the Goodyear blimp. I was very unhappy. The drugs were good, which was all okay. And of course, there's something very comfortable about having a catheter that makes it easy when you want to go to the bathroom. If you can just picture Steve Martin in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, he says, excuse me, may I go to the bathroom? Thank you.
Yeah, it's funny you quoted that movie. That's a great film.
Well, I don't do the Oklahoma, Oklahoma, Oklahoma anymore. But certainly there was a certain joy and comfort to having a catheter.
Mm-hmm. Any message for your fans who are listening out there?
I miss you. That goes back to the echoes of the cheers, doesn't it? You know, you go to autograph sessions from time to time, and it's nice to see the fans come up, and you can smile at them and take photos with them and sign and do all those sort of things. And, you know, I'm actually quite proud of the fact that I've got a small entry into the legends of the WWF, or WWE, I guess. You know, page 228. It's great to be in there. It is a sense of accomplishment. See, I treated my job and my time at the WWF as being a representative of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Being a national representative, it was important and imperative that I put a good foot forward.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, like half the crap that happened to me on the road might have been my fault. Who knows? And, you know, people say, well, why didn't you fight back? There were times that I did, but I always, always put the show first.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Could I have squeezed Dynamite Kid's head like a pimple? Of course I could have.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, everybody at that point, that selection of, 200 men were the 200 biggest, strongest, toughest men in the world. I mean, anybody could have crushed anybody. And, you sort of think at that point, could we classify ourselves as the 300? At that point, without a doubt, in my mind. And that may be stupid and misguided, but I think we were. We were absolutely shoulder to shoulder, the without a doubt, the 300. And I took that very seriously because it's important. It's important for what you're projecting for a fan. And it gives that fan that moment of suspension of disbelief where he actually gets to meet a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be a hero.
Let's say on behalf of all of us at Online World of Wrestling, we wish you good health. And I got to tell you, Outback Jack, this was really one of my favorite interviews in a long time. Thank you so much for being here today.
David, it's an honor and it's a pleasure to be here for the fans.
Take care of yourself. We'll talk to you real soon.
I'll be waiting for your call. Bye-bye.
Don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Till next time, I am David. Thanks again to Outback Jack for today's excellent interview. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio.